But it's getting stuck. Hang on. You finally went off. Very good. My guess is all those FM transmitters being combined into one single FM antenna. All of that filtering network, I'm guessing that probably fills up what? 5 by 5 by 5 would be more than 100 cubic foot is that filter network. Is that a rough guess, Eric? KE2EJ, KQRIW?
Well, I don't know exactly how many stations in that particular location. I think it's probably a bit bigger than that.
Yeah, in order to make a very low loss filter, usually called a cavity resonator, it takes volume. You want your conductors to be very, very large in diameter. The center conductor of this rod in this coaxial reentrant filter, you'd like that center conductor to be very large in diameter, so it has very low loss. A cavity resonator filter, what is it really? If you take a cross section of it, it's a piece of transmission line, very large transmission line, the equivalent of a 6-inch diameter air heliax. It's a very large diameter transmission line with a shorts and opens on the ends. So
they're all fed with 3 1/8.
Okay, so you're saying the cavity resonators are only 3 1/8? Is that what you're saying?
Transmission line leading to the filter. I think the center, the probes of not quite 6 inches.
So 6 inches in diameter. So if that's true, then it's the equivalent of a 15-inch heliax, if there was such a thing. Is that true, Eric? Go ahead.
Say that one more time.
If the center conductor is 6 inches in diameter, and it's the center conductor, the reentrant rod of a cavity resonator, if I looked at that cavity resonator in cross-section, I'm saying every cavity resonator is a piece of air-filled transmission line with shorts and opens on the ends, so the signal bounces back and forth. That's where the resonance is coming from. That's where the very low insertion loss is coming from. So if your center conductor rod of your cavity resonator is 6 inches in diameter, then the cavity outer diameter is a lot larger. That's a really big piece of equivalent heliax. That's what you're looking at in cross-section. KE2EJ, KQRIW, and the TechNet.
KQRIW, KQJ. Now, what you're saying is true. I mean, if I try and relate it to something, if you're familiar with the size of, say, a smart car, maybe just a little smaller than that.
That's a big filter. So, in order to get very low insertion loss and very high Q of filtering, you must take up a lot of volume. Your conductors have to be large in diameter, made out of very low-loss materials, copper and maybe silver-plated. But you got to be careful with the silver-plating. Just because you've silver-plated some copper doesn't mean you've lowered its loss. Because depending on how you got the silver there, it can be very granular and can have higher resistivity than raw copper. Oxygen-free, surface copper can have very low loss if you keep it in a dry, nitrogen-filled environment. And so the way you treat your cavity filters, I guarantee you wouldn't mount them outdoors. My guess is they're in a very controlled environment to make sure they don't shift in time. Is that true, Eric? KE2EJ, KQRIW?
Yeah, the walls of the cavities are really heavy. You know, as compared to, say, what we're using for the repeater and the duplexing filter, those things really, all they have is at the top of the cavity is really just a little loop between the center conductor and the shield of the cable that's feeding it with a little capacitor there that you can actually tune. But, yeah, you don't put these things outside, and they are in a reasonably temperature-controlled room. I think the actual ratings for them is something like plus or minus 20 or 30 degrees, and that's it.
And there's another thing to worry about. You've got this very highly Q-tuned filter at a very narrow frequency of region where you want it to work. And unless you've used materials to make that filter that have zero expansion, there is a kind of metal called zero door, which has no expansion rate as a function of temperature. Most things, copper for instance, grows in length when you heat it up, shrinks when you cool it off. So that's going to be shifting your resonant frequency. There's all kinds of compensating networks, careful choice of materials. In the case of almost every cavity resonating filter, the short-circuited end is where you've got to be very careful. A simple lap joint on the cover on the short-circuit end, if there's any copper oxide in there, it can really mess up your performance. You want the number of ohms in that area to be small fractions of a micro-ohm of resistivity of where materials are touching each other. And it's kind of funny that the resonating rod you have to treat so carefully, but the signal that is injected and the signal that's coming out is a simple little loop of wire. It's kind of amazing, the juxtaposition here of simple and very complicated stuff to make it all work. AC2IS, the guy who got us into the series of questions tonight, K2RIW, go ahead, Bill.
Okay, Dick, when last we left off, I was about to outline another slightly different scenario. Instead of fixed-mounted antennas, let's say we've got cars with mag-mounted antennas on top of them, two operators both on 2 meters who don't want to be interfering with each other and desensing each other. So, you know, let's say they've got fairly typical mobile gear mounted in their vehicles. I'm guessing they should not be parked in adjacent spots in a parking lot and attempting to operate at the same time, because they would be desensing each other and there'd be a lot of coupling between the two antennas on top of their cars and might not have adequate isolation. I'm setting up these questions in hopes of coming up with an answer of, you know, quote-unquote, it depends. But I kind of think there's a good chance that that will be the answer, because I'm guessing that the amount of isolation that each front-end isolation that each radio will have will depend on, you know, how many kilohertz apart the two radios are tuned, things like that. AC2IS.
Oh, that's a loaded question.
There's a relatively simple answer to this one, though, Eric and Bill. The closest way that we quite often experience this is you and I are both on this repeater in our automobiles, traveling the Long Island Expressway. I'm starting off in Huntington, I'm traveling west. You're starting off in Queens, and you're traveling east. We're both on the same repeater. We're approaching each other. When we are a fraction of a mile apart, maybe it's 1,000 yards, maybe it's 1,000 feet, all of a sudden we get to the condition where, as I transmit, the amount of signal out of my transmitter at 146.25 gets into your receiver front end that's listening to 146.85. I'm transmitting, you're listening to the repeater output, and pretty soon you don't hear the repeater. The only way you can hear what I say is to flip to the input frequency. So there are times when two automobiles talking to a repeater are a few hundred feet apart. The overload of the front end of the other receiver is going to stop you from hearing the repeater signal. Now, there's a huge difference here as to what pieces of equipment are being used in those two automobiles. Let me drop it. If I used Cadillac equipment with real high dynamic range of the front end, with good filtering and whatever, if I had the right kind of a bandpass filter, I could mount the two automobiles side by side in adjacent parking spaces and both talk through the same repeater 5 miles away, and the two cars are essentially touching each other. With high enough dynamic range, the right kind of filtering on those two pieces of electronics, I can make that work. You'd have to work pretty hard to make that work, but you can anticipate that. This situation is not too different from what happens at every scene of a fire department. Almost all fire departments, the firemen are carrying handy talkies that talk through the repeater of the fire department. But when they get on scene, because of that descent problem of two firemen standing up 20 feet apart, both trying to talk to the repeater and pass information back and forth. One's inside the building, one's outside the building, where a fire is being fought. They have a procedure by which they switch over to a simplex frequency, knowing they're going to get descents, because that degree, let me drop it. That degree of high dynamic range radio with high degree of filtering, you cannot squeeze that into a handy-talkie. So you just give up and go over to it. They know on the scene they have to talk to each other on a simplex frequency. So that's some of the answer I think you're looking for, Bill. AC2IS, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Comment?
Go ahead, Joe.
Two. Depending on the Motorola portable, and I use old Motorola equipment, I've been doing that for like over 25 years now. They make these radios with fairly dynamic receivers, and one thing I've noticed in these things that it contributes to that is they use a very high level local oscillator in the injection into the mixer, much higher than you normally find that of typical like Jap radios, and I think that's a contributing factor of why the radios don't hear into mine out of band or even stuff close by, because it takes a lot of signal to overload the radio because the mixer is being hit with a fairly high level from the local oscillator. Back to you.
Yeah, very good, Joe. The rough rule of thumb is that a mixer will behave correctly if the RF signal going to the mixer is always 10 dB weaker than the local oscillator going to that same mixer. Assume the mixer is properly designed for that high level of local oscillator. Once the RF signal gets strong enough so it's less than 10 dB weaker than the local oscillator, pretty soon the mixer gets confused. It doesn't know who's LO and who's RF, and it starts making a hell of a lot more what are called M-by-N products, Mike-by-November products, M-by-N products. M is an integer, 1, 2, 3, 4. N is another integer, 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. So the second harmonic of one mixing with the third harmonic of the other is going to fall into your receiver frequency, and you're going to get grief. So high-level mixers require a hell of a lot more LO most of the time. There is another fancy way of doing it with field effect transistors, active mixers, if you know what I mean. KE2EJ, K2RIW, go ahead, Eric.
2RIW, KE2EJ. I wanted to point out a couple things. First of all, there's different kinds of mixers that have different ability to deal with the IP3 products that they make. There are some radios that actually have some really good filtering in the front end that actually change the center of the bandpass of that filter according to the frequency that it's tuned to by using Veracity. But the other thing I really wanted to point out is that the newer stuff that is digital today, which includes P25 and DMR and NXDN, because transmission is directed and is done in time slots, this problem of descents doesn't occur with these types of radios. So, I mean, there are solutions, but of course, like anything else, you pay for what you get. So if you already have a system that you've been working with for the last 20 years and you don't have a budget, you've got to deal with what you got. K2RIW, K2J.
So I think you're saying you can get isolation in the time domain. In other words, your transmission is really digital pulses where there are on periods and off periods, and the receiver knows when the on and off periods are occurring, and so therefore the receiver is not simultaneously listening during a transmit period. Therefore, you could have two pieces of electronics side by side acting like there is no descent because they've got this time domain sharing of a particular protocol of transmission characteristic. Is that true, Eric? KE2EJ, K2IW, and who makes that thing that we just described?
K2IW, K2EJ. Well, they're short duration. They are actually broken up into little bits, and it depends upon the protocol. What we call DMR was developed by this group in Europe, and it's widely used all over the place, and it solves a lot of those issues. And the timing is actually slightly offset from a time of packet is transmitted to a time of packet is retransmitted and received. So there's some dwell time in between transmissions per packet. And there's different manufacturers. I mean, Motorola, DMR, there's communication systems. There's Kenwood, there's this one, there's that one. And Kenwood is more into the NXDN, which is their preferred method. But, you know, everybody's got their method, but it all follows a similar type of scheme. So some of the problems that we deal with in analog don't present themselves in the way they do in the digital world, like they do in the analog world. K2RW, K2J.
There are people who think that everything you can possibly design into radio has already been done a whole lot of years ago. Oh boy. In some of these modern digital techniques. After we finish with Bill, I'm going to, for a short period of time, go over to Eric, who's going to tell us the latest about the fact that our current 8VSB over-the-air digital television is about to be abandoned, and our television sets, to some degree, are all going to become obsolete in the next few years. We're all going to flip over to this COFDM technique, which is the more European technique. And so, in the big picture, it looks like the United States made a decision with our 8VSB, which was a pretty good decision, but there could have been a better one.
Dick is describing, generally doesn't happen because you have 5 megahertz difference between the receive frequencies. When you're talking 2 meters, that's only 600 kilohertz, and that's pretty close. Generally, the front end will be detuned enough on UHF that you won't actually have that particular problem. And as far as field day goes, there's any number of ways to do things. We don't necessarily put antennas right next to each other on the same band. And generally, during field day, you're operating one band at a time, or a different band at each station. So you don't run into that problem quite as much. And a lot of field days, we'll do multiple HF bands into one antenna using something that's called a triplex, which is just a series of filters. K2RW, K2J.
I agree with all of that. And Bill, you came to the conclusion that because the 600 kc of separation between transmit and receive on a particular repeater is not enough, you can experience desensitization. You could even have on 2 meters greater separation and you would still experience almost the same amount of desensitization. When your receiver in your mobile radio is listening to 146.85, that front end RF amplifier stage into that first mixer is looking at almost a whole DON 2 meter band all at once, 146 to 148, so to speak. And so even with 2 megs of separation, you'd have less descents, but you would still have it. 2 meters is also a lot more vulnerable to this descent because a pair of 2 meter antennas 1 mile apart versus a pair of 450 antennas 1 mile apart, because of the free space loss, 20 log F, 3 times higher frequency. The log of 3, I think, is when multiplied by 20, I think there's 10 dB more loss between two antennas on 450 versus two antennas on 2 meters. Roughly 10 dB more loss. So the free space loss on 450 between two automobiles gives you another 10-to-1 improvement in power transmitted from one to the other. Somebody had a comment on that?
Yeah, I also wanted to throw in there that even if you have the two antennas near each other, you're not going to damage the receiver, because I get that sense of that's what he's thinking.
Yeah, I just did the calculation. A 3-to-1 frequency region between 2 meters and 450 is 9.5, let's call it 10 dB. So, two isotropic antennas on 2 meters versus two isotropic antennas on 450. A fixed distance apart, like 1 mile. 10 dB more loss on 450. That gives you more protection. So, better separation, better filtering, better free space loss, isolation. There's all kinds of reasons why on 450 you get less of this phenomenon. On top of that, we tend to be a little bit more tolerant of sensitivity numbers on 450, but I won't go there. I'm going to pick up John, KC2WGB, after we discuss his situation for, it's going to take a good 45 minutes in my opinion. Then if Eric is still with us, I'd like to know more about what's going on with our television switchover, that we're about to lose our current standard. Let me double check. Eric, are you going to be with us 45 minutes from now?
Dick, I'm working on something, so I'm not going anywhere.
Did Echo Alpha?
Okay, blank blank Echo Alpha. Echo Alpha, go ahead.
2 Zulu Echo Alpha, can I get on the question Q?
Yes, we'll put you on the list. And we're going to talk to John, Eric, and you in that order. Zulu Echo Alpha, what is your name, sir?
Glenn.
Okay, Glenn. John, KC2WGB. I've had a little bit of a hint ahead of time. John has been designing an exotic antenna, and he's made some measurements that at first seemed a little bit strange, and I think much of the strangeness can be explained. He's into an area which is not very often experimented with ham radio operators, but there's a lot to be learned from this area. KC2WGB. K2RIW, go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Good evening, Dick,
Paul,
Eric. Good to be talking to you again. I wish to apologize for my absence with the mailbag. I hope to have it returning soon. It's just because of some medical things that I'm going through. But if you have a pen, Dick, I'll give you a construct, a little descript on the construct, then we can take it from there.
Because of the quick conversation you and I had on this, I can also describe the antenna, if that's what you want. And your antenna is a subset of the John Krause helical antenna, which comes in both the cylindrical form and the tapered conic form of helical antenna. So go right ahead, Joe. John, KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Okay, very good, Dick. As I described, I have a picture an ice cream cone. It's not truncated, a complete cone. And I took some solid number 14 wire and wound a coil on that cone form. It starts at about a 5-inch diameter from one end and goes to a point. All right, after that was constructed, I took it, the bench is horizontal, of course. The longitudinal axis of the cone is parallel to the bench. I glued that coil, this conical coil, to a dowel, wooden dowel, which is mounted in a hole in the bench so that now I can rotate it and change its azimuth. Got that description?
Sure do. You called it a chopstick. A dowel is a good way of calling it. So the antenna is mounted on the dowel, glued to the dowel. The dowel is going into a hole in the bench so it stays vertical, the dowel. The antenna, the axis of your cone antenna is parallel to the desk. Therefore, you can rotate it. And therefore, as you rotate it with a receiving antenna some number of feet away, which you call a panel antenna, going into something like a spectrum analyzer in the zero sweep mode, or maybe even, not in the zero sweep mode. As you rotate the antenna in azimuth by rotating that dowel, you are therefore looking at the antenna pattern as displayed on your spectrum analyzer screen when picked up by that panel antenna is probably a few feet away. Is that roughly the scenario of your measurement, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW, and the tech man?
KC2WGB, absolutely, that's it. The panel antenna is approximately center-tuned at 5 gig. This whole thing operates at 5 gig. The panel antenna is about 5 inches square, maybe 3/8 of an inch thick, something like that. That is connected to a spectrum analyzer. That is mounted vertically. So the flat panel is like a TV set looking at this antenna. What I found strange, and there's two points that you can straighten me out on, I found that the major emanation was from the point of the cone and from the wide opening of the cone. I thought it would be parallel, I thought it would be a 90 degree transmission from its longitudinal axis, but it's not. Okay, that was one surprise. And as I rotated, here's the thing. If the point of the antenna, the point of the cone is pointed directly at the panel, I find that I have a particular amplitude. When I reverse it, the amplitude doesn't change much, maybe 1.5 dB, something like that. But the bandwidth changes, which I found was amazing to me. Why does the bandwidth change? So those are basically the two questions. The bandwidth is, I'm sweeping from like 4 to 6 megahertz. I tapped in from the generator. I fed the coil. The first coil was soldered, the wire directly. Then I picked a group of coils. I kept going down until I found a resonant area, and then circumferentially rotated the connection until I found a very nice resonant area. And that's where I made my, I made no other moves now in measurement except rotating it in azimuth 180 degrees, found the bandwidth changed from maybe 1.8 gig to
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Say about that.
Yep, when it comes to helical antennas, the man who we believe invented it, according to his own book on the subject, John Krauss, W-H-A-K, from Ohio University. He was the head of the electrical engineering department at Ohio University for a whole lot of years. I believe he's a silent key now. And I have visited one of his facilities, the so-called Big Ear, in Miamisburg, Ohio, that great big radio telescope he had set up. And his original radio telescope at that exact location was 96 helical antennas mounted on one very great big panel, which could be rotated in elevation. Let me drop it. If I took a large, ordinary cylinder, like a large diameter piece of PVC pipe, and wrapped a 14-gauge wire around it with a certain spacing of all the turns, and now I feed a radio signal into that helical antenna, there's two different ways the helical antenna can radiate. If each individual turn of the helix is close to one wavelength in circumference, the majority of the signal is now radiated in the axial mode. The signal flows down the center axis of the helix, gets transmitted into space as a primarily circular polarized signal. By the way, John is familiar with all these things. I'm giving you guys this information to see how this all relates to what John has just done. Let me drop. So if each turn of the helix is close to a wavelength, you get the helical mode transmit circular polarization along the axis. If your individual turns of your helix are very small compared to a wavelength, you get the transverse mode. The signal radiates broadside at right angles to the axis of your helix is where the major signal is radiated. The rubber duck antenna on your handy talkie is a helical antenna that radiates in the transverse mode, radiates essentially broadside. Because each individual turn on your rubber duck is so small compared to a wavelength, it doesn't radiate in the axial mode. If it did, it would straight, it would be aiming a signal straight up. Now, there's a way you can slide from one to the other. If now your helix, now your antenna is no longer a cylinder of wire, it's now a tapered cylinder of wire. You wound it onto a conic shape, onto a cone. Now you've got small diameter turns at one end, large diameter turns at the other end. You're halfway between the axial mode and the transverse mode, and you get both modes. You can launch a signal along that wire with various techniques, choose the right feed points on that wire, the right number of turns, the right number of degrees along one of those turns, to put your center conductor in your shield of your coax cable, for instance. Let me drop. You're now launching a signal onto this cone, and you could launch it from the small end or the large end. It makes a little bit of difference. but the majority of the signal, like on every antenna, is going to bounce back and forth some number of times within the conductors of the antenna, and therefore the signal gets eventually radiated. At the short circuit end, the turns are so small that it primarily radiates the transverse mode, broadside. At the large diameter end, it's starting to radiate the axial mode, a circular polarized signal down the axis of the antenna. You get a little bit of both. Okay. Every antenna, with rare exception, that has physical, that the conductors within the antenna are more than, let's say, a half wavelength long. And this helical wound antenna, you've got many wavelengths of signal at 5 gigahertz where he's using this. Let me drop this. Whenever within your antenna, you're launching a standing wave on the conductors, which are multiple wavelengths long, you're going to get a complicated antenna pattern. Somewhere you're going to have a strong signal that you call the main lobe. On a whole bunch of other directions in azimuth and elevation, you're going to have a whole bunch of things that you call side lobes. And somewhere 180 degrees away from the main lobe, you're going to have something you call a back lobe. So this antenna has multiple wavelengths of conductor, all doing their separate radiation in various modes. Therefore, if you could make a three-dimensional picture out of this antenna pattern, it would be like an apple pattern that you get out of a Satomo machine, one of these machines that does a three-dimensional antenna pattern plot of your particular antenna. It would be like an apple with a whole bunch of hills and valleys, a whole bunch of mountains and valleys in that pattern. So it's radiating lobes all over the place. And each of those lobes can have a different polarization, a different amplitude, a different location and azimuth and elevation, and a different beam width and a different bandwidth. All of those lobes are independent events. In some particular direction, the standing wave on that piece of wire radiates a signal in that direction that has a certain polarization, a certain bandwidth, a certain beam width. So each of those lobes are independent events. Let me drop it. Even though at this instant of time, John is feeding the signal 5.0 gigahertz of signal out of his signal generator. One particular frequency is going into his antenna. But he's got multiple wavelengths of standing wave on that piece of wire, and the wire is wound with various diameters at the narrow end versus the broad end. So it's generating a whole lot of lobes, and each lobe is independent. So common sense would lead you to believe the majority of the signal you would think is going to come out of the broad end or the narrow end. Not necessarily. And is that signal going to be circular polarized or linear polarized? And each of the lobes coming off the side at other various angles, are they linear, circular? To be very gentle, every one of those lobes is some degree of elliptical polarization. Every one of those lobes can have a different location in three-dimensional space. Every one of those lobes can have a different bandwidth and a different major axis and minor axis of that elliptical polarization. This is a simple-looking antenna with very complicated analysis. You try to do a paper analysis, you try to model this on some of the better computer modeling programs, you'll get a pretty good answer. But if you really, let me drop it. You really want to know what's going on. You've got to be doing the antenna lab radiation pattern measurement. If this is the best of all worlds, John would have an anechoic chamber in his garage, and he'd be doing this measurement with laboratory equipment traceable to the bureau. And the fact that he's got a wooden bench and a panel antenna a few feet away, close enough for ham radio purposes. He may measure a side lobe that is 5 dB down, and with perfect anechoic chamber, he may find out it's 6.25 dB down. Close enough. So for him to now detect whether or not the particular lobe is circular polarized, in theory, he could have two panel antennas out there, one that's clockwise, one that's counterclockwise, in its reception characteristic, and compare the signals and the phase angle between the two, and he would be doing an experiment in what's called polarimetry. There's ways you can set up an anechoic antenna range such that you simultaneously measure the polarization characteristics as well as measuring the pattern and bandwidth of the antenna. So That's quite an experiment you've got going there, John. I wonder how long ago you started this one. And this one can keep you off the streets to the wee hours of the morning for many days to come. You've got a fairly complicated experiment there. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Right, KC2, John.
John first, then we'll go over to Eric. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Okay, very good. Yes, I did not realize that we could have that amount of difference in the lobes. I thought that that rear emanating lobe would be, even though the amplitude is almost exact, it's within a dB, dB and a half of the pointed end of the cone. I did not understand the bandwidth at negative 50 dB, where it just comes out of the noise floor, being almost 2 megahertz, 3 megahertz difference. But after having that discussion with you, I understand it now. And you may want to mention, I believe you said, the Compton lobes, just to tip people. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
John, on a couple of occasions you said 2 or 3 megahertz different. I wonder if you meant 2 or 3 gigahertz different. Over to you, John.
No, the bandwidth was in megahertz. I was only sweeping from 4 to 6. Let me see. Yes, 4 to 6 was the sweep on that. And I was looking at about the negative 50, which was just above the noise floor where I could tell accurately where it was coming out. And that's where I noticed the difference.
You're sweeping 4 to 6 gigahertz, 2 gigahertz of sweep, and you're measuring bandwidth. And unless you clicked a whole lot of changes to the dispersion on your spectrum analyzer, you wouldn't easily be able to see 2 megahertz of bandwidth when you're sweeping 2 gigahertz of frequency region. Give us some repeat on that, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW, wait for the beeps.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, it was like 1.6 versus 1.8, and I could tell that because of the markers I put there. You couldn't tell it by eye, but with the markers, I could see that difference. That's how I was able to discern that, and that's what bothered me a little bit. I didn't understand how that could happen.
So you're sweeping 2 gigahertz. By way of the markers, you could resolve 1.6 megahertz of bandwidth of a particular lobe. Is that what you're saying, John? Go ahead.
Yes, that's correct. I brought the markers in right at the, just above, just where it came out of the noise at about negative 50. And that's where I could see the difference in the markers. If I moved them to where they should be, that was beyond the width of the bandwidth.
And if you've got a piece of coaxial cable that is multiple wavelengths long, or in this particular case, you've got a piece of wire where you're launching a signal on it, which is multiple wavelengths long, and it's a standing wave structure. In other words, only a small amount of the signal is radiated on the first pass of the signal along the wire. And the signal hits the open circuit end of the wire and reflects back. That's why it's setting up a standing wave. And so, where your coax cable or your wire is multiple wavelengths long, you don't have to sweep very many megahertz at around 5 gigahertz before all of those bounces go in phase or out of phase, and therefore you get a peak or a valley in the radiated signal and the amount of current that each of those lobes, the current of the lobes of the standing wave pattern on the wire from one method of analysis, that's where the majority of the antenna pattern radiation is coming from. The whole reason why you resonate an antenna so that it will radiate is so that at resonance, you've got a certain amount of Q. Q is defined in 5 different ways, but one of them is current rise at resonance. So because you get a current rise at resonance, if it had a Q of 10, the current would be 10 times higher at resonance, and therefore you get a lot more current, and the current locations are where the majority of the antenna pattern radiation is coming from for one particular method of analysis. That sort of explains why you have a certain enough bandwidth of these lobes. KE2EJ, K2RIW, go ahead, Derek.
Did you have a comment on what you said earlier?
Hello, Dick.
I wanted to
mention that the transverse mode type of antenna, which is actually called a normal mode in my world, that actually almost looks like a 50 ohm antenna in terms of impedance. But in my satellite days, I've made a number of axial mode vehicles, and they tend to be about six. I got happy around six wavelengths long, and then played with the radius in terms of its wavelength, and that seemed to affect gain a lot. The hardest problem I had is trying to deal with the ground plane, the reflecting ground plane, and its exit. You know, as you feed the helix itself, I played a lot of different games with it. When it's in axial mode, the impedance turns about 200 to 300 ohms, so you've got to match it if you want it to work well. The question I have for John is, how many wavelengths long is the antenna that he's actually playing with? K2RW, K2J.
Eric, the length of the cone is about 8 inches. The length of the wire, I don't have an exact measurement on that, but the turns are going in that conical shape separated by approximately a half inch.
So you could easily have more than a foot of wire on that cone, is that true? Or maybe 2 feet of wire? Rough guess, John, go ahead.
Oh yeah, I would say 2 feet, Dick.
Okay, 2 feet of wire, 24 inches, 5 gigahertz is a free space wavelength of roughly 2 inches. So he's got 24 divided by 2. He's got 12 wavelengths of wire. Every half wavelength is a node. So he's got 24 peaks and valleys of current along that wire because of that standing wave. KE2EJ, K2RW, go ahead, Eric.
No, I was wondering, because all the stuff that I read by, I think it was Krauss and I forget the other guy's name. After you hit like 7 wavelengths, you don't really get much of an increase in gain. And it also affects the pattern.
If you insist on using constant turns ratio, that is true. By the same token, if I built long Yagi antennas and every one of my directors is the same length, after 13 elements, I'll say the Yagi runs out of steam, and making it any longer is a waste of time. You start going into the more exotic designs of Yagis, where you allow individual directors to be individual lengths and individual spacings, then with good Yagi design, you can get nearly full performance out of a Yagi of 102 elements at 5 gigahertz. That was a product being sold by Directive Systems, K1WHS, Dave O'Lean in Maine, when he ran his antenna company. So you have to allow the elements to be changing in length and changing in spacing in order to support that particular slow wave structure velocity profile that gives you maximum gain. By the same token, if you allowed your helical antenna, I didn't say it's easy, if you allowed your helical antenna to change in circumference for each individual turn and spacing of each individual turn, if you allowed your helix antenna to do that, you could get a hell of a lot more gain out of a hell of a lot more length of helix. I wonder if that's ever been brought to your attention, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
No, I wasn't even aware that they made them papered, so that's why I questioned it. Because I spent a lot of hours making UHF and 1232 and what was it, 2.4 gig helical, and I've done it in a lot of different methods with, you know, cardboard tube, pieces of plastic, post. I think you saw one of them. I had it on the roof at when I was living in Astoria, because I was doing a lot of satellite work in those days. So I'm just trying to visualize how this tapered thing works in terms of wavelength and it bouncing back and forth. But then again, you know, it's another thing that John mentioned in terms of bandwidth. I've never seen anything with such little bandwidth. I mean, the helical antennas tend to be very broad. K2RW, K2EJ.
Your particular helical antenna had a nearly constant circumference, His is a thoroughly variable conic shape, so it's a very different antenna. The first quarter of a turn of a helix antenna in front of the ground plane that's behind it, the flat, the circular disc usually, that first quarter of a turn, you use various spacings to the ground plane and put various tabs on it to do impedance matching. So that first quarter of a turn is a very complicated tuning procedure to get a good impedance match of a helical antenna. You wouldn't have to go through all that rigmarole had you been using a double stub tuner going into that antenna, Eric. Life would have been a lot easier because what you do, that's what I wound up doing in the end. Doesn't surprise me because that first quarter of a turn, you're doing all kinds of manipulations of that first quarter of a turn looking for the magic setup that gives you a good impedance match.
The foil would get you close.
But what I'm trying to say is that first quarter of a turn, all of that diddling you do with it to get an impedance match has almost no effect on the antenna pattern, antenna gain, and so on. The multiple turns are where the real action is taking place. The way you launch the signal in that first quarter of a turn to get a good impedance match, as far as the antenna is concerned, doesn't matter if you're using something like a double stub tuner. So life became a lot easier when you did that. And so I think you said beyond six turns or six wavelengths, whichever you said, you got no increase in performance for your particular design criteria. Constant circumference, constant spacing. Is that roughly true, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
After seven wavelengths, it starts to become diminishing returns. It moves very slowly after that. But another thing you can play with, which actually there seems to be a peaking point if you manipulate the radius of the turns. I can't remember, it's been such a long time ago, but I think it actually was just slightly longer than, I'm not absolutely sure, but I think it was slightly bigger, when the circumference was just a little bit bigger than a wavelength that actually found where it was maximum gain. But then again, when you're making those kind of measurements in an uncontrolled space, and you don't know if you're getting stuff on the table or the ground, wherever you happen to be testing it, but that's what it seemed to turn out to be.
In any of these experiments, Eric, did you use a linear polarized sensing antenna and rotate it in order to measure axial ratio? How good was the circular polarization? Did you ever look at any of that? Over to you, Eric.
Yes, I did. I also had some helicals that were made by a friend of mine. One was right-hand circular polarization, the other one was left-hand circular polarization. And it was interesting when we pointed them at each other and even rotated them. Yeah, I've tried a number of different ways of measuring it, from a dipole to a monopole to other circularly polarized antennas, just for the heck of it.
When you're setting up a non-anechoic antenna range, the world's best antenna range is a good anechoic chamber where all signals hitting the floors, walls, and ceilings gets absorbed and nothing bounces. Now you're measuring the antenna pattern. But almost all of us on VHF frequencies are forced to use a reflective ground plane antenna range. We've got a floor that's reflecting. We may have some walls and ceiling and file cabinets and everything else that's reflecting. In that environment, testing circular polarization is a severe test. Let me give you an example. Assume now I have the world's most perfect circular polarized helical antenna. Then in the normal mode, the axial mode, it radiates a signal down the axis of the helix, perfect circular polarization. Some of that signal I'm radiating is bouncing off the floor. Some of it's going directly to my sensing antenna. Can we drop? A circular polarized signal bouncing off the floor clockwise becomes counterclockwise. The direct signal in the air between the antenna and the sensing antenna stays clockwise, we'll say. So now at the sensing antenna, you've got a clockwise signal off the floor, off the air, and a counterclockwise signal bouncing off the floor. And whenever the two mix together, if the amplitudes were identical, you would end up with linear polarization. And depending on the path length, that linear could end up horizontal, vertical, slant, 45, left or right. So you're getting a perfect circular polarized antenna in a reflecting environment is going to always look like elliptical polarization. You rotate that sensing dipole antenna, and you're going to see peaks and valleys in polarization. And now you have to ask yourself, is it because my antenna is doing that, or the reflection off the floor is doing it? And the answer is yes and yes. Just how much of which? So circular polarized antenna testing is a severe test, and there's only 10 ways you can get false alarms on the quality of your antenna in that environment. You have to do all kinds of heroic things to make sure that the ground bounce is not giving you grief. In the case of linear antenna testing, linear polarization testing, there are magic distances of the antenna under test being off the ground and the sensing antenna being very close to the ground, where you could make the lobes come out so that the lobe reflecting off the ground and the lobe coming straight are in phase with each other. With linear polarization, you can do that. With circular polarization, that breaks down. Let me drop that. So, in the usual environment where you and I are likely to test an antenna, if we don't have access to a very good antenna range, by the way, an anechoic chamber that operates below 1 gigahertz, there are very few of those in the United States that have high performance below 1 gigahertz. They're very expensive. The cones coming off the wall have to be multiple feet high to get very low anechoic characteristic below 1 gigahertz. So to make an anechoic chamber at 10 gigs is easy. To build a good one at 400 megahertz, out of the question with any reasonable amount of money. So that's part of what you were up against when you tried to measure the quality of your circular polarization, Eric. KE2EJ, K2LAW in the TechNet.
K2LAW, KE2EJ. Well, as I mentioned, I was doing this with a friend of mine. When we set it up in the house and set it up on the bench, it just made us absolutely crazy. We could tell, as we made the antennas, the differences between them, putting things exactly in the same place and having a standard of what it looks like. But since he had a barn, and he had two towers that were put 100 feet apart, and we mounted the antennas at about 75 feet and pointed them at each other, and whoa, what a difference. It didn't even look like the same thing that was in the house.
You are making your antenna range more and more beautiful, more and more ideal. 100-foot towers, 75 feet up or whatever, spacing at each other. Now, the extra path loss down to the ground and up at some crazy angle is a lot more suppressed by inverse square law as well as the geometry, and therefore the signal becomes more pure. The most anechoic antenna range in the world is free space. If you and I could set up an antenna range where two astronauts floating in their spacesuit, 1,000 feet behind the space shuttle, in free space, and we got our antennas aimed at each other, and the ground below us is 130 miles down, 130 nautical miles down, that's anechoic. All signals you radiate, they got nothing to reflect off, if you know what I mean, except the other astronaut, and there's ways of controlling that. That would be a perfect anechoic chamber. Another way of making a very good anechoic chamber is to make it so darn big that reflections off the wall are so many feet away that by inverse square law, the signal becomes so weak that you can make believe there's no reflection. So building the chamber really big, or using free space that's really big, or using some very expensive anechoic material at VHF frequencies are about the only ways. Well, there is one other way. This is the so-called compact antenna range technique by which you use this very large parabolic reflector aimed in the far field to give you a very flat field of illumination to your antenna. And now you can make some very good measurements with a limited amount of space and volume. Again, it's an expensive technique. When you're testing an amplifier sitting on the bench, you got an input connector, an output connector, and a 15-volt input lead. You're testing that amplifier. You try to test an antenna in any environment you're likely to come up with. You're testing the antenna plus the environment. The reflections off the things in the environment are contaminating your test. So antenna testing, there's only 10 ways of doing it wrong, if you know what I mean. And you can do it by ways that look like a lot of common sense, and you'll get an answer. The answer could look very good, to what you expect, but it must be dead wrong. I think you've got a question along these lines, Rich. N2EO, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. N2EO. Well, my comment was, or question, whatever you want to call it, you keep mentioning John Krause, who indeed was a smart individual, well-trained, in Miamisburg, Ohio. Is there any relationship with John Krause and the Drake Company, which is also located in Miamisburg?
Okay, there's a missing word there. John Krause and the blank company. Spell that out, because I heard the sound. I didn't know what it was. Over to you, Rich.
Okay, Dick. John Krause was in Miamisburg, Ohio. So is the Drake Company. Is there any correlation?
He's saying Drake.
Yeah, the way he's pronouncing it, I almost couldn't hear the word Drake, D-R-A-K-E. Could be a coincidence. I never heard that John Krause worked at the Drake Company, so it could be a coincidence. And Drake made some very nice products at one time. So there I don't know, Rich. Okay. So back to John. So therefore, John, you've got what we believe is around 12 or 24 wavelengths of wire being fed at 5 gigahertz. A very complicated standing wave pattern is setting up along those, the current and voltage along that wire. The wire itself is wound into a constantly changing circumference conical shape. Therefore, you can get lobes all over the place. Let me drop. Because you've got so darn many wavelengths, and each individual half wavelength section of the standing wave on your wire is doing its own radiating. So you've got all of these individual 24 sections doing radiating, and as they stand at some particular point in space, the radiation from standing wave, you've got 24 standing waves, so I got 24 little current peaks and valleys. So the current peak from peak number 5, 15, and 17 happens to all add up in phase when I'm looking at this particular side lobe, and at some other angle, different ones add up in phase or outer phase and so on. So you can see now some of the mechanism by which you can develop with your multiple wavelength thing, very complicated pattern in space. Each of those lobes are to some degree an independent event, even though they're all at 5 gigahertz, we'll say. They can have their own individual amplitude, direction, polarization, and so on. And so it ain't easy to predict what you're going to get with this thing. You've made a rather complicated structure, an interesting structure, and set up correctly, it can be very useful. Let me drop. When it comes to electromagnetic interference testing, and you go to the Emerson Cumming Company, I think it was, of the various products they sold at one time, one of them was a very broadband receiving antenna, which was a conic-shaped log periodic spiral. And so the feed line went down the back of the wide-angle end of the cone, down the center, and fed the narrow angle of the cone. It launched signals into a pair of wires that were helically wound, and this was a very broadband receiving antenna of known antenna characteristics. And you set that up into a chamber where you're doing electromagnetic interference, radiated field testing. That was a very broadband antenna that had a relatively flat frequency response over roughly a decade of frequency. I think one of those things ran from 1 to 10 gigahertz, for instance. So there are ways of setting up a conical light antenna to be very broadband, quasi-circular polarized, and very good for certain kinds of testing. So I'll eventually think of the name of it. It may not have been Emerson Cumming. Maybe it was Donna McGowan. I think it was Donna McGowan that made that particular EMI testing antenna, which I did use on a number of occasions. KC2WGB, K2RIW, you got it, John.
KC2WGB. Well, I wish to thank Eric and you for the explanation, and I realize my mistake.